George McGovern. It's a vote for America, huh?
I tell you, with the things that are happening in our culture, he may run again. Okay, we're just getting the sound set here. If you have your syllabus, you may want to turn, or you will want to. So page 13, it's not numbered, it's the one right after 12. I did that sequentially, that's more helpful for us. We'll be following this fairly closely, and it's going to be difficult for me to tell you when to write and when not to. There's not a lot of writing this session, and probably you can give most of your attention up here. I came across an interesting little book this week, and I thought if those of you that are interested in studying the culture and really don't have the time to put into buying all the books that I have in my library, some of them aren't worth reading because of the language and so on. I can't really endorse them. But I came across one that's kind of a pedestrian level version, does a pretty good job. It's the history of Barbie. She's been around a while. She was released, as a matter of fact, in 1959. And you can trace, well, let me just read a real quick sentence to you out of this because I think this is important. This is from Candace Irving, who has been the marketing, one of the main people in charge of marketing Barbie for the last 12 years. She makes a statement that Mattel's marketing approach has been to keep her in the mainstream. In 1959, for example, her face and hairstyle reflected the beauty trends of the day. She was introduced as a teenage fashion model, so she had the sultry look of the models of the time. We quickly discovered that this is a formula that works. It's the principal contributing reason for the Barbie doll's longevity. She is always contemporary. I think Barbie is every little girl. I disagree with Ms. Irving on this point. She is the person they are working out how to become. She is very personal to every little girl who plays with her, representing their fantasies of what they'll be as a teenager or an adult. Barbie has always been a sign of the times. We are working hard to keep her that way. Barbie is a friend and a role model and a lot of fun. And I'm not going to bore you with this. It's rather interesting. I'll leave it up here if you want to look over it. You can just see some minor significant trends. She was driving an Austin Healey in 1962, got a Corvette in 1977. In 1982, I think it was, got a Corvette with a cellular phone. Barbie is now driving a Ferrari 328, which sells for $150,000. And it's interesting to know, and I'm not the kind of person that's going to come out preaching against G.I. Joe and the Smurfs and say they're demon-possessed and all that kind of thing. But as we go through this material, you're going to see that oftentimes we as Christians are the dumb ones because the marketing people in the secular world, they know exactly what they're doing. When I talk to young people about rock and roll, and I say, do you know who Spencer Dryden is? And they say, yeah, he's the drummer for Jefferson Starship. I said, do you know what he said? And they said, what? And I said, Spencer Dryden said that we're moving after the mines, and so are most of the big groups. Do you know that? And they don't know that. They think that they just buy a tape and they can kind of boogie and it's fun music. And they don't realize that the people behind the music, they have a philosophy on life. They're artists. They're trying to communicate something as much as Joe is. And the people that manufacture dolls, particularly this one, I did not make up these quotes. She said, we're trying to set a role model for young people. And I don't have a problem with dolls. I don't have a problem with my daughters playing with dolls. I do have a problem with Barbie's values and whether or not I want my children to have those values. And but this is a real interesting, honestly, a real interesting history of American culture starting in 1959. You talk about the Eisenhower era and it goes all the way up to the present. Did you know there was a Woodstock Barbie? Can't picture Barbie. It's in here. She has a fringed, leather-fringed outfit and here it is, Barbie in America. The Woodstock Festival 1969 turned out to be more than a rock concert. Here she is with Ken. He's got the fringe thing, and they got a guitar and a miniskirt and long, you know. And she went to matter of fact, right in the same year, it's 1971, they came out with a Barbie and Ken crash pad, their own little pad. You remember pads?
Yeah.
You want to come over to my pad, man? You know. She has a condo right now with a jacuzzi and her own workout club. So Barbie's a real good trend, and I didn't really realize that. We were in Target looking around, and I saw this book, and I started paging through it, and I about died. Just realizing, I mean, it makes sense. I feel dumb for not catching it sooner, but it makes sense that you could trace the history of American culture with a doll that was designed to represent culture. The one thing Candace Irving probably would deny is that Barbie is not only reflecting culture, Barbie is contributing to forming culture, and she would probably deny that, but that's okay. Okay, we're going to look at, I think as long as Joe prayed that we'll just get started. I'm going to try my hardest, honestly, to stop at 10. And then if there's time for if there's some questions you have, I'd like to take 10 or 15 minutes to entertain those. If you get some discretionary time today, 5 or 10 minutes, I would appreciate prayer. I just have a real burden to scrap what I was going to share with you tonight and start over. So that's not... Conference speakers don't do that kind of thing. They usually come in and speak, and if you don't get anything out of it, then obviously you're just not tuned in to the truth of God. And you have an attitude problem, and I'm just trying to be open to the Spirit of God. So I'm real nervous about that. I don't like to, don't like to change plans. I'll talk to you about that on Friday. I'm a very structured person, and I like to know where I'm going and where I've been. And I have a real problem sometimes because the Holy Spirit doesn't seem to operate that way. I wished he did. But, you know, one of the things that has become more obvious, I think, I like Herman. He's a cartoon strip. Not sure if you appreciate Herman or not, but he catches some things from time to time that I think are real good. And one of the things is the truth that our children a lot of times think we don't know where we're coming from. And we don't understand them. And we make these efforts to kind of be relevant and cool. Some people go to greater or lesser extremes for that. You all have got to know some guy in his 50s that's trying to dress like he's 17. And we make these gestures. And our children can see through that. And communication is an age-old problem. This is gross, but this is my favorite cartoon. Oftentimes, just getting a word wrong is all it takes, and we just miss the point completely, you know. And isn't that gross? We've all eaten at places like that, haven't we? Oh, you know. And the idea of communication oftentimes, I think, is our children can see right through that, and what they really want us to do is to be ourselves instead of try and be like them. Because they're not sure who they are yet either. And but I think the whole getting back to the purpose for the morning sessions is for you and I to try and understand our children, understand more so the culture that they're in, understand ourselves, and we're going to do a lot of that Thursday and Friday, and hopefully maybe redirect and reorient our lives. And that's kind of what I'm going to shoot for this morning. Being an educator... I need to review with you, and considering that we're all close to the same age, I have some idea of how much stuff stays with us, and there's an awful lot going on this week. It's been a marvelous group, by the way. I've really enjoyed this. It's a lot more fun than I thought it was going to be. I've spoken in front of thousands of people. I was in front of 6,000 people when I was 15, so that was... I love a crowd. You know, if I can't get one, I'll create one. And that's why teaching has been a fun profession for me. This is the first conference I've ever done. So this is a new experience for me. And it's been fun. I want to go quickly through what we covered yesterday with all those slides. We had looked at the 50s, and we had said that the culture itself had pretty much was in agreement with the system. In other words, the systems of authority, church, home, government, and education. People had resigned themselves to life doesn't get any better than this, and they were enchanted with it. Music, we said there was a clean break from pop to rock in 1955, 50, probably around 57, when 56 actually, when Elvis made the scene. And the message of music was non-existent at that time. the doo-wop and the wop-bop and loop-bop and all that stuff. It wasn't really a vehicle of philosophy, and we know that that's going to change in the 60s. Rebellion, we said, primarily was in the form of an attitude, captured in the movie by with starring James Dean, Rebel Without a Cause. Something's wrong here, but we can't put our finger on it. And I mentioned that the counterculture was born, a group of people philosophically saying that they want to live in opposition or antithesis to the parent culture, and that was in the form of the beatniks. We said that the early 60s pretty much picked up where the 50s had left off, but then as the decade went on, things changed, and that the culture, all of a sudden, we began to see a disagreement with the system and disenchantment with life, and the resignation and resigning myself to enjoying life had been replaced by demonstration. And all of a sudden, there was activity going on all over the culture. We said that the music was all of a sudden carrying a message, and the message was that there was an uneasiness and a searching. And I mentioned yesterday, just in passing, that that's one of the things you need to see about the ideology of drug taking in the 60s. People were genuinely looking for something in life, and they thought that drugs was a vehicle to find what they were looking for. And they were told that by people that they respected, like Timothy Leary. Rebellion was now in the form of action, and the counterculture was massive. Even in styles, we saw a tremendous change in styles about this time, didn't we? The guy that played lead guitar for the band I was in high school, he had hair about as long as yours, not any longer than that. And this was in 1966, and 67 really. And the Beatles had come out, and that was the Beatle haircut. And he was fired as a swimming pool manager in our little town in Nacusa. His dad was a physician, one of the few doctors in town, and here's a doctor's son. And that was the mentality in a small town. I was talking with a family this morning. In our town, we grew up, the clergymen and the physicians, they were the people that were the pillars of society. And here was a son of a physician that had his hair as long as yours. And he was canned, lost his job. And oddly enough, his dad's wearing his hair like that now. But then we said this moved into a tremendous sense of optimism in the latter part of the 60s, particularly 68 and 69 with Woodstock and all the things that were going on. And the rebellion just kind of paused. Now, the parent generation was real excited about this because they saw the problem with the revolution of the 60s. And so when the noise and all the hoopla ceased, they thought the 60s were over. And so did the church. The church was grateful to have all these dirty, long-haired drug freaks kind of backing off a little bit. And we looked at that yesterday, that wasn't really the case. And we said in the early 70s, what had happened was all of a sudden the cultural mood is a total change. And we see a tremendous sense of depression. Genuinely, you can mark it almost on your calendar in 1973. The songs I quoted to you yesterday were all from the same time frame. And we saw yesterday, and someone had mentioned to me that they had never seen this put in its context before, which excites me because that's the whole purpose of this thing, is the fact that the spiritual vacuum that was created by the collapse of the 60s opened a Pandora's box of cult influences and occultic influences and acceptability. And this is a critical point, acceptability for an Eastern mindset. Eastern religions were just considered absurd by those of us in the parent culture. But all of a sudden, we are more, at this time frame, we are more open to that. And we're going to see that that was really an essential paving that brought us to the point where we are now. Music was incredibly pessimistic. We saw that in the lyrics. And rebellion was really a form of frustration. People just were trying to figure out what had happened. And I don't honestly believe that the counterculture itself, many of them have put together what's happened. A couple have. Good book, it's got a little tiny bit of bad language in the early chapters, is called The Destructive Generation. And it's on the 60s by David Horowitz and other guy's name is Collier, I think. They were the editors of Ramparts magazine in the 60s, militant left-wing magazine. And they've assessed the 60s and said, hey, we blew it. All right. Now, there's other people coming out saying exactly the opposite. Annie Gottlieb's book, Do You Believe in Magic, subtitled that is called The Second Coming of the 60s Generation. And I was talking with Randy before the conference, and one of the things that people who are involved in marketing, like Randy is, they have got to deal with is the baby boom phenomena. You cannot ignore it. You look at the people born between 1946 and 1964, we make up one of the largest or the largest sector of the population. You can even follow advertising trends on TV, folks. They're marketing to us. They're marketing to us. Or they're marketing to our children via us. It's either us or our kids. And marketing to our children is the same as marketing to us, because that's usually where most of the money comes from. And so we are a sector that's got to be dealt with. And I honestly believe that something is stirring. And I have a whole theory on this that we can't even touch on this week. But I, just to whet your appetite, and you can think it through for yourself, I think the church is coming back to Kadesh Barnea. God's people came to Kadesh Barnea, sent the spies in, they came back and said, we can't do it. And so God said, all right. They said, you're going to kill our children in the wilderness. And it's almost like God says, oh, is that so? Well, I got news for you, folks. I'll tell you what I'll do is I'll kill you, and I'll take your kids into the promised land. How's that? And that's what he does. Lets them wander for 40 years till that generation perished, and then he took their children in. Because they accused God of not caring for their children. And I think we are maybe coming to Kadesh again, and by that I mean I think our culture is almost at a similar point. People are asking a lot of the same questions. The jaded materialism of the 70s and the 80s is burning people out, and they're looking. The only difference is that the new age is there this time, and the culture's been softened. And if you look at the age level of a lot of people in the new age, you can guess what age they are. They're our age. They're boomers, right? I'll tell you, be honest with you, and I hope this doesn't offend us, but my fear is that the church is going to blow it again. Because you know why? Because I think we are just starting to believe that we can have the jaded opulence that the secular culture had in the 70s. We can have it all. And we're going to talk a lot about that tomorrow. But I my fear is that we're going to blow it. You got young people, high school age young people, and college age young people are asking questions again. And I think, let me just do something. I've been wanting to do this all week. How many of you became Christians between 1968 and 1973? Raise your hands. Okay. I really think that there's a unique homogeneity about this group. How many of you had rather late life conversions, college time or later? Raise your hand. Look at this. Isn't that interesting? When we prayed that God would handpick the group, I wasn't thinking of something like this. But we all have a common ancestry almost. And I think that's real interesting. Okay? Well, what we want to do this morning, that was all review. What we want to do this morning is take a look at the 60s, figure out what questions were they asking, how did they fail? And I think one of the things that people fail to realize, and it's important from the very beginning, that we need to kind of dissect the 60s into two facets. One would be the ideology, and the other would be the activities. The things that were going on, this would be what people believed. And there were a number of very common things that were going on in the youth culture in the 60s. One of them, and these are in your syllabus, so you don't even need to look in there if you don't want to. Other people are valuable. That was a very important part of the 60s ideology. It was not uncommon to find whites marching for blacks and blacks marching for whites and both of them marching for something else. It was not uncommon to be able to just borrow someone's car. Unfortunately, you could borrow their girlfriend if you wanted to. I mean, it was that loose. But there was a sense that people are valuable. And I mentioned that, I think, yesterday, that if we had had the abortion question raised in the middle 60s or the early 60s, when David Harris and the boys were down in Mississippi working with the Freedom March and so on, I don't think that the abortion issue would have gone the way it did. Now, I could be wrong, but the disenfranchised were a very big focal point because of this. We believe that other people were valuable. There was a second thing, was this idea of togetherness. In other words, there was a sort of we mentality. And you know what? I've sensed that here. I sensed that in talking with you, that what's kind of us. We went through this. We were there. We this. And I think that is true. And I think Annie Gottlieb's idea that there's something almost mystical that bonds the 60s people together or the baby boom people together, there's some truth to that. But one of the parts of the ideology is that we're all kind of one big happy family. The whole commune, the hog farm and all those things where people tried to live together and have their own little community was based on this one. Third one was the significance of the individual. Allard Lowenstein was who was a real visible and vocal part of the 60s counterculture. Matter of fact, the book Dreams Die Hard by David Harris. David Harris was one of the early guys down in the South working down there as a white boy amongst the black community in the early 60s, like 61. And Lowenstein kind of was a charismatic figure that drew Harris into his mentorship in a sense. David Harris later went on to marry Joan Baez. Maybe that name makes a connection. But he makes a statement, I've quoted this in your syllabus, he's talking about Lowenstein. He argued that one person can make an immense difference and that the course of history itself could be shaped by a single decision. Every person should take his life seriously, he urged, and devote it to worthy efforts. So this idea of the significance of one person was real important. We have almost lost this because of the impact of statistical shock. You are so overwhelmed globally with the needs of the world that it's real easy for you and I to believe because we can't do it all, we can't do anything. And so sometimes we're lulled and numbed into disaction. It's part of the reason Chuck Colson and guys like him are having such an incredibly difficult time raising our consciousness to get involved in prison ministries and so on, is because we just are, I don't know about you, I don't know how many pieces, I do know how many pieces of mail you get a week from organizations that need your money because they've got a worthy cause. It's half of our mail at least goes in the garbage every day. And we are just overwhelmed, and so we do little. They were absolutely convinced that they could do a lot. And the fourth one was the evil of the system. We talked about that. That was a common denominator. We were unconsciously taught to mistrust anyone over 35. We laugh about that now. You could trust me. You know, that boy, 35, man, those old folks. Isn't that something? Isn't that something? What about the activities? What was going on? Well, the marches and the protests. How many of you know that there were marches and protests in the 60s? Raise your hand. Okay? Keep your hands up. Way up high. Okay? How many of you participated in one? How many of you saw one? Okay. 20%. How'd you know that there was marches and protests if you didn't see one or participate in one? TV, we're going to talk about that, right? Second thing was the drugs, cohabitation, and moral, and this is a key one, autonomy. The idea of I'm not accountable to anybody. Don't tell me what's right and wrong, because I'm not accountable to anybody. That was one of the activities of the 60s. We can do what we want. Remember the mamas and papas? You got to go where you want to go. Do what you want to do. Whoever you want to do it, babe. Do it. And that was the title of Jerry Rubin's book. Do it. The other one was the costumes. Oh, we're embarrassed now to talk about what we wore. Bell bottoms that covered your entire shoes. I had a pair of blue jean bell bottoms, had 13 buttons down the fly. They were so wide you couldn't even see my feet. And then I had a shirt that had red and white stripes here and a blue top and white stars and my hair is out to here. Yeah, and I was a Christian. And I got asked to speak at a little conservative Bible thumping church in Wisconsin. And I shared my testimony. High school kid that introduced me said, he said, if you're like me, I'm sitting back on the platform. He says, if you're like me, you're probably wondering the same thing I did. Could Fran Shaka really be a Christian? That was my introduction. He said, bet he is. So I got up and I shared my testimony about how God had delivered me from a life of drugs and all that sort of thing. And the lady who was in charge of Christian education sent me a tract in the mail. It was by that very moderate organization, the Sword of the Lord. And it was called, I still remember the tract. It was a little brown tract. It was called Skimpy Skirts and Hippie Hair. Maybe some of you have seen it. I was very grateful for the warm reception that my ministry had in that congregation at that time. But that was really typical, wasn't it? They couldn't see past the costumes. Stuart Briscoe, who has an uncanny ability of saying abrasive things without offending you, was speaking at a pastor's conference once around this time frame, and someone says, "I don't understand why these kids got to be walking around looking like a bunch of mops." And he said, "Well," he said, "it's probably for the same reason that you guys all walk around looking like a bunch of toothbrushes." That was his statement. Now, the truth was is that we all had our costumes, right? And I just, a little aside, there's a lot of weird costumes today, all right? And your children, some of you probably are wrestling with your children over what they can wear. If you've seen my son, Jeff, he has a little tail in the back of his hair. Now, maybe you've already judged him for that. I don't know, okay? I'll tell you why he has that tail. And I'll tell you a whole lot more why tomorrow, or Thursday and Friday. I know Jeff's heart. And my little son Jeff's heart beats for people. And Jill and I have really tried to figure out what we're going to go to the wall for and what we're not. And I'd encourage you to do the same thing. I'm not talking about anything in particular, but prayerfully consider what's worth fighting. I mean fighting. I mean battle. I don't mean just an argument. Because you can win a battle and lose your child. And half the stuff that we want to take our kids to the wall for, it just doesn't matter. And I get frustrated having taught at the Christian school the things that they get uptight about. And matter of fact, I even thought, you know, if I could prove to these people my theory of cerebral evaporation that, in fact, if you have long hair, it would improve your SAT scores, they'd change the dress code up there. Which tells you how biblically based it is to begin with. But we need to be able to see past the costumes. When I think that I used to wear polyester, and some of the, I don't mean polyester just itself, but boy, some of the stuff I had as an adult, and I think, boy, different. Another thing that characterized the 60s was violence. And that was one of the unfortunate things. I think it was partly because of the level of frustration. And I am not in any way condoning that. Jill was semi-connected to the fellow that bombed the University of Wisconsin in Madison. Strange turn of events. A girl moved from Madison. Parents moved, folks, moved across country to Colorado Springs so that their senior daughter could attend our school. They had investigated Christian schools all throughout the United States, and they moved their entire family to come to our school. I was absolutely awestruck by that. And she was schoolmates with a daughter whose dad's office got bombed in the 60s. And when she found out that the guy that Jill was dating in the 60s, one of his friends was responsible for that, it was just a weird circle that came around. And you and I, when we're younger, we don't realize the impact of things, you know. God's weaving a tapestry. You know, it's neat our threads have crossed for a week, and I bet you they'll cross again. And that's kind of a neat thing. It can be a scary thing, too. But these were the two sides of the coin. And I already kind of primed you on the fact that the media propagated this, didn't they? You saw all the pictures of the police beating people. You didn't see a real lot of the protesters beating the police. That wouldn't sell too well. But they, all the ones of them beating the protesters and all that stuff, and the marches and the be-ins and the love-ins and the drugs. Did any of you ever see a special in that time era when some anchorman interviewed somebody and said, "Tell us, you know, where are you guys coming from? What's your ideology?" I never saw that. You never heard it. And so what you had was the media served to propagate the activities without the message. And I told you last night, and I think it's true, is that the kids in the 60s, and I put myself in there, I think we were asking the right questions. What's life all about? Are people important? What's to be my values? Is there really a basis for social inequity? What about war? I mean, just what about it? And there was a lot of questions that were asked, and I think they were the right questions, many of them. We didn't come up with the answers. And in many ways, the parent culture, our culture at large, didn't provide the answers either. But what we did see was that the media propagated and perpetuated the activities We said last night, excuse me, yesterday morning, that something began to happen. What was it that led to the crater in the early 70s? And I think one of the things, this is an excellent transparency, I think it communicates well. what had happened was that the counter system, we realized, was a sham. The counter culture had no counter culture to put in the place of the parent culture. You follow me? We did an excellent job of destroying confidence in authority, which wasn't all that good. I'm not sure Watergate would have happened, not the crime, but I'm not sure the expose of Watergate would have happened had we not gone through the 60s. It became very vogue to mistrust authority. So it's cool to unearth sordid things about JFK now that he's dead, instead of letting the man just lie in peace and leaving his family alone. And I think a lot of that came out of this questioning of authority in the 60s. But when it came time to rebuild, nothing in its place. And I think something else happened that was even more serious that we didn't fully recognize that really brought the death of the Aquarian dream into the forefront. We had kind of created the idea in our own minds that there was us, and the thems were the problem. Authority, education, government, etc. And I think one of the truths that dawned, probably individually, not corporately, was the fact that if this circle represents the problem, then in fact, we were in the circle too. It's like that famous cartoon. We have found the enemy, and he is us. And I think one of the things that dawned is that we had blood in our hands too. The problem, and I don't think we realize this at a conscious level. Theologically, I know exactly what we dealt with. We dealt with the fact that man is depraved. And that's me too. It's not my mom and dad. It's me too. And so I think it began to crumble, began to fall in. There's some quotations in here that I even mentioned one of them to you. Oz Guinness. How many of you have read his book, The Dust of Death? Anybody? Okay, that was released in 1973, Inner Varsity. At 16 years old, incredibly good research on the failure of the counterculture. And I'm hoping to kind of pick up the ball where he left off. I doubt if I'll do it with the scholarship he did. He had about 60 footnotes in each chapter. But he said that the great refusal became the great betrayal. And something I didn't mention last night, the same year that we were hooting and hollering in upstate New York and New Jersey at Woodstock, the same year, in Altamont, California, while Mick Jagger was standing on the edge of a stage singing the song Sympathy for the Devil, a group of Hell's Angels beat and clubbed a young black youth to death right in front of the stage. And the Hell's Angels had been hired for a couple of cases of beer by the Grateful Dead to be the bouncers for the concert. And the Rolling Stones Illustrated History of Rock and Roll, which is a huge book, mostly pictures and a lot of description, said that Altamont came to represent what the counterculture had become, ugly and dead. And that's exactly what happened. I think we dealt with the fact that we were part of the problem. And I mentioned yesterday, and I need to just zero in a little bit tighter, I think that caused us to turn inside, turn inwardly for emotional survival. I think the 60s was a time of tremendous output. All right, how many of you in your personal lives have given and given and given to somebody and got burned, and you decided that you're not going to do that, at least for that person anymore? Has that happened to? Okay. Well, that happened on a generational level. Man, we gave and gave and gave and gave and gave, and we got burned. And I think what happens then is you begin to turn inward. It's a self-protection. God probably even built it in. And I think what you have then happening is the people begin to look inside. Taking of drugs, Eastern religions, all of those things were paving the way to what was to become one of the major fruits of the failures of the 60s. And that was a preoccupation with ourselves. A preoccupation with ourselves. Instead of being, if you look at the 60s, you could diagram it this way. That it was all out. And if you look at the present, which is a direct consequence of the 60s, it's like this, isn't it? It's all in. You know, something else that you may not realize is that I personally believe that the tremendous dedication of the Moonies and the Hare Krishnas and stuff, being willing to get 4 hours sleep and sleep on concrete, eat mashed potatoes and noodles, and sell flowers out on the street corner to give it to some Korean guy who is already a millionaire. By the way, I have a real problem with the Messiah that ends up in jail for tax evasion. But he was taking all this money in. Now, why would they be so dedicated? Is it because they believed in a cause? I don't think so. That had died. They were looking for this. A tremendous sense of belonging and a tremendous sense of self-gratification, I think, is what was one of the underlying factors that brought kids into the cults. Not some sense of the dedication to the 60s. And I think people, because they happened so close together, I think people think it was the same thing. I don't think it was. I think they were looking for something inside. And this is carried over tremendously. Our preoccupation with ourselves. American advertising, to me, is probably the best place to look. Is it really possible for a car manufacturer to build excitement? Really? You know, we're buying cars for this reason, folks. Or some guy jumping up on the screen and going, "Oh, what a feeling." Or you deserve a break today. Saw a thing for taking hair off a girl's legs. I don't have any desire to take any off mine. But it said, "This I do for me." Department store in New York has a self center. It's called the Self Center. The magazine Self. I mentioned that to you last night. There's a new one that came out. I just glanced through it in the newsstand. I can't remember the name of it. But on the spline of the magazine, it says, "For women who weren't born yesterday." And the whole thing is, at least the ads in there, are all for beauty aids and all that kind of stuff. You know, or getting rid of those horrid age spots. You see those commercials. Or getting rid of gray hair. Because gray hair, apparently, I don't know, it's a symbol of age. You know, in our culture, we worship the young and put the old in homes. In Japan and China, they almost idolize the old. Because they have some sense of wisdom. Study the scriptures. Rehoboam, Solomon's son. Remember that whole story? Goes to the old counselors. "What should I do? Man, be cool with the people. Your dad was a class A jerk." And he was. You may not know that. Solomon was not a nice guy. He extended the boundaries of Israel and built all these edifices at their expense and free labor. And they were tired of it. Went to his buddies. He said, "What should I do?" They said, "Man, put the screws to those turkeys. Tell him, you think my dad was bad. You haven't seen anything. My thigh, my dad's thigh is about the size of my little finger. He's chastised you with whips." He did. "I'll chastise you with scorpions." So he gets up. Whose counsel did he follow? The young. Gets up. And they said, "Bye." Kingdom split. And it never got back together. Now, I get a little nervous when I see the age of the leadership in our country sometimes. Or in our churches. I know churches where the average age is 30 years old. That scares me. We go to a little tiny church because the men in the church are in their 50s. There's a group of older men that I can look up to. Otherwise, you can guess what happens. We go to a church. "Hey, man, this guy's been to seminary. Let's make him an elder. Let's make him a pastor. But I think, in matter of fact, in the book of Jeremiah, which, if you haven't guessed by now, is my favorite book, he says it's a sign of God's judgment when children and women, I'm not a male pig, but he says that it's a sign of judgment when leadership in a nation is dominated by women and young people, for what that's worth. But anyway, we are being lured into the self. They're pandering us and marketing to us. I think my father, I've never asked him, but I would guess, although he was in the Navy. How many of you are in the Army? Okay. What do you think of the advertising slogan, "Be all that you can be"? Okay. It's not, "Hey, remember Kennedy? Ask not what your country will do for you, but what you can do." This says, "Hey, look, man, we got a deal for you. We'll give you everything. Just come. We need you." Sure, you get more people in, but look how they're drawing us. That's the thing I want you to see. And we're going to talk a whole lot tomorrow or Thursday about how we have bought into that as Christians. We really have. Alan Bloom, best quote I've ever seen. The great change is that a good man used to be the one who cares for others as opposed to the man who cares exclusively for himself. Now the good man is the one who knows how to care for himself as opposed to the man who does not. Of course, we are told that the healthy, inner-directed person will really care for others, to which I can only respond, if you can believe that, you'll believe anything. This guy's not a Christian. Okay, what else has happened? One of them was the preoccupation with the self. Second thing that's happened, and I'm going to go through this one rather quickly, there's been a change in the basis of morality from external to internal. People can make statements like, hey, man, that is really cool for you, but don't lay that rap on me when you talk to him about the Lord. Who are you to tell me I can't live with my boyfriend? Where do you get off telling me that? Who are you to tell me? I had a guy from another country that came and studied at our school. And he was real offended when I challenged him about cheating. He said, everyone cheats in our country. Teachers know it. He said, you can't get ahead if you don't cheat. Who are you to tell me I can't cheat? Let me show you what's happened, though. And this is real interesting. I'll do it quickly. I think we've seen a progression. And part of it is due to the fact of various previous generations not passing on the whole thing. Passing on, we talked about this the first night, I think. We can pass on the procedures, but we fail sometimes to fail to try and pass on the passion, the why. We give them the what, and the when, and the where, and the how, but a lot of times not the why. We started out with the biblical morality, the 19th century, early part of the 20th century. Certain things are right or wrong, and I know why. You ask my great-grandmother, is it wrong for you to commit adultery? She'd say, yeah. And you say, why? She'd say, God says so. Okay? Well, then it got changed to what I call a-biblical morality. Early 20s with the rise of liberalism, all the way up into 1950 with the death of God idea. Certain things are right or wrong, but I don't know why. This is my mom and dad. How are you raising Fran? Well, we're raising Fran to work hard, not to cheat or steal, and to be a moral and honest person. Well, why? Because those, well, those... What do you mean, why? What kind of place would it be if he wasn't? Well, then you go to the 60s. Certain things are right or wrong, I don't care. But here's where we are now. There's no such thing as right or wrong. And this is really the climate of the college campus. It's also more than likely the climate of the people that you're around at work and so on. People living together. I took a poll of my seniors. I said, how many of you know somebody who's living with a person they're not married to? 80% at 85 seniors. And we spend a semester on marriage and family. Jill comes in. We even have our children come in sometimes. And they go, I mean, it's good stuff. It really is. Down-to-earth, hard-hitting, heavy stuff. And then they'll, two or three of them will graduate and move in with somebody, having been through all that. And I'll show you why as we get into this. There's a neat quote, if you get a chance to look at it, by Ted Koppel that I think is really good. We've gotten to the place where we think slogans will save us. Safe sex. That's stupid. The issue is safety. No, it's not. The issue is chastity. And we saw a special on television. The guy said, well, they said, what are we going to do about the sex epidemic? He said, well, obviously the best thing would be chastity, but that's totally unrealistic. So let's not even try it. We saw a bumper sticker in the back of an Anheuser-Busch truck yesterday on our way to our house. Drink responsibly. Smoke responsibly, you know. Do drugs responsibly. Be unfaithful safely. Slogans. Just say no. I love the one where they have you seen the one with the frying pan? Okay, let's go through this one more time. This is your brain. This is your brain on drugs. And you just know all those kids are out there going, that's it? First thing, preoccupation, inward self. Second thing, the basis, shifting the basis of morality from outside me to inside me. I decide what's right and wrong for me. Third one was a perpetuation of the activities of the 60s when the ideology is gone. It's not called the activities of the 60s anymore. It's called the drug problem, the teenage pregnancy problem, the abortion problem, the AIDS problem, the sexual preference problem, although that's not what it's called in mainstream culture. Quick quote from Annie Gottlieb. If the right wing gets to write history, they will put us down not as the love generation, this is a non-Christian, by the way, flaming New Ager, but as the generation that destroyed the American family. They will point to the soaring rates of divorce, venereal disease, teen pregnancy, and abortion as sequelae of the 60s. If they are right in their attribution of blame, in other words, if they're right that we really are responsible for all this stuff, then ironically the 60s generation achieved one of our main objectives. We might not have been able to tear down the state, but the family was closer. We could get our hands on it. And like the Confucian Chinese, we believed that the family was the foundation to the state. Culture doesn't believe that, but the 60s generation did, as well as the collective state of mind. In other words, if we could split the family apart, we could free love, just like splitting the atom and freed energy. But here she says it. If the right wing gets to write history, they're going to blame us for abortion, pregnancy, teen sex, everything. And she said, they're right. Now, that's a non-believer saying that, the activities of the 60s that we see in the 70s and 80s are a direct consequence of the 60s culture. But we call it problems. Last one, the fourth one, is a preoccupation with the present. So there's four things so far that the 60s failures has produced. One was a preoccupation with self. Second one was a shift in the basis of morals from outside me to inside me. Third one was a perpetuation of the activities. Fourth one is a preoccupation with the present. And there's two reasons for that. One is that the American young people's perspective on the past has changed. And their sense of connection to it is gone. Two things, separate but very important. And I'll touch on these real briefly. It's dealt with pretty extensively in your syllabus. America's perspective on the past, the perspective of American youth in the past is pretty much that it's irrelevant. This is best illustrated by one of the top shows, one of my favorites, by the way. It's A Teacher's Dream because this guy has a script. Head of the Class. Any of you watch that? Okay, Charlie Moore teaches the accelerated history class in Gifted Kids, and he uses history to illustrate points for the present. And you take what can very easily be diagrammed as teaching history this way. You have this point, this point, this point, this point. This may be the Magna Carta. This may be the Gallic Wars. This may be Caesar. This may be Napoleon. This may be World War I. And you pick one. And you bring that up and you use that to be illustrative of some relevant present thing. And the problem with that, folks, is that American young people have no idea of the fact, and this is so, so critical, history is linear. That means it has a beginning and it has an end, and you know what it is? You need a straight line to give meaning to any point on the line. You can't do it this way. This is nothing but a bunch of random events that are totally unrelated. A Christian view of history is that it's linear. It started and it's going to end. And you know what else? I can't have any sense of personal meaning if history's not linear either, because I don't fit on a line that has a beginning and an end. I'm a random spot in space. 1973 textbook spent 8 pages talking about Marilyn Monroe, or 7 pages, and mentioned George Washington's name 8 times. Just mentioned his name. Deals with Che Guevara, Bob Dylan. Doesn't mention Alexander Hamilton and guys that were involved in the formation of our country. Doesn't mention them. Because history is not important. Christians are accused of censoring textbooks. And I'm here to tell you, if you have your children in public school, you need to at least examine their history books. It's one thing to promote religion. It's another thing to rewrite history by omitting history. That's important. That's serious. I can give you a total different view of my life if I leave certain events out. We had a friend in town that wanted to come in and talk about Thanksgiving. They wouldn't let her. She said, well, it's a time when the pilgrims gave thanks to God. Oh, no, it wasn't. It was a time when they gave thanks to the Indians for the corn. Well, okay. So their perception in the past is that it's irrelevant, not connected to it. Jill's parents and my parents, when they bought a house, probably your parents too, they planted trees before they bought furniture. Because they had a sense of continuity. We move every 3 years. Why plant trees? Goodness sakes. Second thing, their connection to the past. There's a whole issue that's gone, and that's the idea of societal obligation. In other words, that I have some sense of responsibility to the culture that nurtured me. In other words, I have been fed, educated, clothed, and cared for by the American society. I have an obligation to give something back to it. It's like a big pot. I've been eating out of it for 18 years. And now I got a chance to begin to put something back into that pot so that those other people can eat out of it like I have. That's not the orientation, is it? Today it's, and it's Christian kids too. Life is a pie. My job is to get as big a piece as I can. Remember the song about Desert Pete? A long time ago about that jar of water buried in the sand? The sign? Any of you remember that? Come on, you got to. Some of you are older than me. And there was a sign that said, it was in there, it says, take the water, pour it down the well, and wet the rubber in the pump. And then you can drink all you want. But when you get done, fill the jar up and put it back. And our culture, the youth culture today, is being told, hey, forget that nonsense, man. Grab that jar and get off with it. And hide someplace and drink it. I asked my students, how many of you are going into education? I'm not going to be a teacher, man. Why? I'm going to make money. I had one student tell me, he said, I would never settle for the salary you do. I looked him right in the eye and says, you wouldn't? He said, no. I said, but you'll exploit me to get the job you want to make more money. Is that what you're saying? Couple quotes in your syllabus. The one of Rush Dooney's is incredible. You can look at that on your own. William Barclay, it's a sign of a supremely decadent civilization when youth lose all respect for age and fail to recognize the unpayable debt and the basic duty it owes to those who gave it life. We've got a generation of young people that look at the past as irrelevant and I have no responsibility to it. But thank God, when they look to the future, there's hope, right? Politically. Solid government officials. There was no problems with the election. For Gary Hart to stand up and say, my private ethics have no bearing on public policy or public life, that's crazy. Our kids look at the Iran-Contra thing. They look at the abscam. They look at what's going on in government. And we're supposed to tell them to have hope politically, ecologically. My son, literally, he said, Dad, I am so scared that we're going to die because of the ozone layer disintegrating. We talked about that. I said, honey, you know, we can do private things and cause sin in our own lives and wreck things. But when it comes to global issues, God's got a timetable for that. And even the small things in my life fit in there somehow. But I said, this world ain't ending until the final act is done. And you need to know that. You need to realize that history is linear. The end of the world is not going to be determined by man. And our kids need to know that. If we get nuked by Russia, or if we evaporate ourselves, God's not going, oh man, we're losing control here, Gabriel. Let's get this. Industrially, what are our kids learning? We laugh about the commercials about warranties expiring. Guys driving down the road and his warranty expires, his transmission falls out, or his dishwasher explodes, and we go, ha, ha, ha. You know? But we're old enough now. We like to get, if we can get a good toaster at a garage sale, one of those old sunbeams with the round corners, we'll get one. Because we bought two or three already. But our kids are growing up believing that profit overrides goods and services. When I tell my children, you know, things that used to happen at a gas station, they look at me like, man, guy used to wash your window? Yeah. Check my oil, check my air. Talk to me. You know, our kids are growing up going to the store.
$8.95 or $17. Have a nice day.
You know, I mean, that's where they're growing up. But they're growing up industrially believing that profit is the most important thing. Spiritually. At least we got that. Thank God for the church. You know, I don't mean this maliciously, but there was times last year when I wanted to get a hold of those two televangelists and strangle them because of what they did to my classroom. And it's not just a private sin between two consenting adults when you have a position of notoriety in God's kingdom. All right? I don't want to become a household word. I don't. I'm happy being at a small conference in a small town just talking to a small group of people. Right? I don't want to become a household word. I don't. I'm happy being at a small conference in a small town just talking to a small group of people. And Jill and I have been fighting that. I've got a talk that's going to be aired on Dobson next month. I don't like that stuff. I could stop it, but I've wrestled with God and we're holding back as much as we can. I have a theory, man. Satan would love to get you up high because it takes a whole lot longer to fall and a whole lot more people can see you. And I'm not perfect. And I'm not invincible. So we've got our kids, ecologically, politically, spiritually, and industrially, that look at the future. And folks, it doesn't look real good. All right? Well, it doesn't take a genius on our part. If you look at today's teen, that's pretty good. Okay? They look at the future, they look at the past. The past is irrelevant, has no connection. Future's uncertain. Doesn't take a genius to figure out what's left. And we say, why do our kids always just think about themselves? They have no sense of the future. What do you want to be when you grow up?
I don't know.
You know what's underneath all that? What's underneath all that is the idea I may not be there. And there may not be anything there for me when I get there. And so we've got a generation that's been raised believing they have no connection to the past. It's irrelevant, unimportant, no responsibility to it. It's not linear. Future's uncertain, and the message they get from TV, from everything, from music, is me, 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 now, now, now. And it's not all their fault. They're living up in a culture that's a product of the 60s failure. They're being inundated by adults in marketing and advertising, and even the church to a certain extent. Well, if we look at the 60s, I'm going to summarize this for you real quickly. This is in your syllabus. One is that the failure introduced an emphasis on the inner road to personal fulfillment. The self was enthroned as a result of the failure of the 60s. The self was not enthroned in the 60s. Others were enthroned. Second, there's been a total shift in the basis of values. They're now arbitrary and situational. Morals are. I decide. The activities are still around, even though the ideology's gone. Just a parenthesis here. That's why I think it's illegitimate for the college students of today to dress like this. Peace symbols back in. Jewelry every place else. Tie-dyes back in. Radio stations are playing 60s music. It's illegitimate, folks, because they're grasping for some sense of meaning. And they're grasping back to an era when it was characterized by meaning and truth. But they fail to realize that the reason that they're lost is because that era failed. It's called the myth of nostalgia. It's like the Jews in the wilderness. We want to go back to Egypt. Man, we had fondue pots. It was so good. They forgot a few minor details about Egypt. And the culture today wants to go back nostalgically to the 60s, the days of togetherness and belonging. And the reason they want to go back is because there are loss of meaning today that's a consequence of the failure of that decade. Don't forget that. It's important. Preoccupation with the present. Past is irrelevant. Future is uncertain. And the message our kids are getting, what I said, is me, me, me. Now, now, now. That's what the 60s has done. Okay, now that's bad news. That's not real warm and fuzzy. Tomorrow's not going to be warm and fuzzy either. Friday will be positive, upbuilding. But I want you to see where we are. This is where our culture is. Tomorrow or Thursday, we'll look at where the church is, where we're at, maybe. Friday, we'll look at how in the world do we begin to get out. And that's important. So let's close in prayer. Father, thank you for this time and for these thoughts, Lord, for this information. Lord, don't let us just become people who have one more notebook on our shelves. Pray that we'd be men of Issachar, women of Issachar, and that you'd help us to know how to understand the times so that we know what the church ought to do. For Jesus' sake, amen. Yeah.